used to always ask me, she was, how can you be the best bass player? That's what I want to do.
His most important contribution, to take nothing away from his bass playing, was as a composer.
He wanted his composition to be played, so he became the band leader. Not too many bass players are band leaders.
Charles Mingus's Ground, time, note, jazz-breaking 1956 composition, Pithecanthropus erectus. By the time this record came out, Charles Mingus had grown out of Watts, out of Los Angeles, and the West Coast, to establish himself as an innovative bassist and challenging composer. He moved east to New York, to Jazz Central. Mingus was on his way to establishing his legacy as one of jazz's finest writers and most provocative bandleaders. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is Jazz Profiles, part two of our tribute to the multifaceted Charles Mingus, bassist, composer, bandleader, character extraordinaire. Charles Mingus was always creating, inventing, composing, extending the music, and improvising even the specifics of his own history. Saxophonist Buddy Collette knew Charles Mingus about as long and as well as anybody.
It's like somebody saying, hey, give me a sandwich and a salad and I'll be happy and a glass of milk. No, he might have to have syrup on the sandwich and maybe scoop an ice cream in the salad. He was creative. That's the only difference with Mingus. Nobody would do what he would do, and some of that stuff he did worked.
Just because I'm playing jazz, I don't forget about me.
Actor Kermit Frazier reads from an open letter from Charles Mingus to Miles Davis. The letter was published in Downbeat magazine in late 1955, just months after Miles and Mingus had recorded together.
I play or write me the way I feel through jazz, or whatever. Music is or was a language of the emotions. If someone has been escaping reality, I don't expect him to dig my music. And I would begin to worry about my writing if such a person began to really like it. My music is alive. And it's about the living and the dead, about good and evil.
For the musicians who played that music, the experience was also about good and evil. Mingus drove his musicians to distraction, to the doctor, to extending their instruments and talents to places, spaces, sonic possibilities, and ecstasies not before known, by them, by others. Listen to Prayer for Passive Resistance. Hear Mingus shouting at the musicians, pushing alto saxophonist Eric Dolphy, urging him on and out. pianist Jackie Byard hooked up with Mingus in the early 60s.
Horace Parlin left him and went to Europe. He was without a piano player. And that's when I joined the band, joined his aggravation. I used to call it aggravation.
As a band leader, Mingus didn't hesitate to stop and start rehearsals or performances, striking musical flint, hoping for sparks. At least twice, he got fire. The first time was with alto saxophonist Jackie McLean.
And it just happened one night in Cleveland, you know. I said, look, I want to give you my notice, you know, my two-week notice if I can, because... And before I could say anything, you know, he hauled off and hit me in the mouth. When I touched my mouth and saw the blood and felt my teeth were knocked back, you know, it infuriated me, and I pulled my knife and tried to stab him, you know, but it was right over his heart, went through his suit, through his shirt, through his underwear, and into his skin. And that was horrible, you know.
He happened to hit me right in the mouth. I had two capped teeth in front. And he broke off this one here. But he also broke off the stub.
And about an octave for trombonist Jimmy Nepper.
Next day I went to the dentist and he had to pull a stub. And which kind of screwed up my career as a trombone player for a while. And the musicians that knew about this, they said, what do I do? I said, kill him.
Mingus liked surprise, roller coasters without fixed tracks, roulette wheels that rattled rather than spun. Mingus valued musicians' individual sounds, hated hearing, say, the sounds of Miles or Bird coming from another musician's horn, and left a great deal to on-the-bandstand inspiration. At first, Mingus wrote out the music, something he resumed doing near the end of his career. But in the middle, the big 1960s middle, he didn't notate the music at all. Arranger, Cy Johnson.
He taught the musicians by singing to them and by playing their parts on the piano. And he was trying to get them to play every note in a piece as though they discovered it themselves. In that light, in some cases, that actually was the case.
I used to write everything out, and this tenor player... So one day, I said, man, what you cats writing all that stuff down for? I said, well, Frank, I'm writing it down because if I forget, I don't want to forget something. I want to make sure that I have what you wanted down there. This is all for your benefit. I said, and then we're writing this down for posterity. We have something documented. Look, the Bach and Beethoven, they wrote out their tunes and composition. He said, oh, yeah, that's right.
It was a proving ground on the one hand because you had to be very diverse. He required you to do things out of the ordinary.
Alto saxophonist John Handy.
And some people found them provocative. I don't think that some of the musicians found that as provocative, at the audience.
The man himself, Charles Mingus.
I have never said thanks to nobody, because I never need thanks. I used to think I could make it through the world without nobody. Believe me, this is a funny way to feel.
The Village Vanguard, Greenwich Village, New York City. A black-walled, strangely shaped subterranean hole. Or refuge. No natural light. No hint of a world outside. A perfect place for jazz. Max Gordon ran the Vanguard for decades. Now his widow, Lorraine, is in charge. As he did on everyone and everywhere, Mingus left his mark here as well.
He got very angry one night at my husband because we have a little billboard out in, outside that just gives the names of the group, and I think Max put Charlie on instead of Charles. And when Charles got to the top of the stairs, he saw that. He was so angry, he ripped the door off the hinges at the top of the stairs.
He also did some interior redecorating.
He took his bass and smashed it up into the wall, into a light right there over the stage. To this day, we call it the Mingus Light. We never took it down. That's the Mingus Light. Nothing spectacular, but there it is.
I don't think a guy should take his all of his emotions and his prayers and meditations into a nightclub and torture the people with their torments by playing everything they feel. It would be better to sometimes play some things that they imagine might be true.
Like to play a peace title. Oh Lord, don't let them drop that atomic bomb on me.
At times, Mingus ranted on stage about what was by then old news. Sometimes, he used the titles of his tunes as the shorthand for his politics. Fables of Phobos, Free Cell Block F, Tis Nazi USA, Remember Rockefeller at Attica, Meditations on Integration, and this tune.
Stop it, bebop it.
On this track, bass virtuoso Mingus doesn't touch the bass. Mingus leads the session, sings, he liked the sound of his voice, and plays piano.
I've always wanted to play piano, man. At home, I was going to be a piano player, at least in my heart. Man, I just think I would have been a good piano player. I'm sure, you know, everything I compose is on piano. Those things have all been played first by me on piano, or else I wouldn't give it to any musician to play.
What was annoying is when we'd walk into the place, he would already be there sitting at the piano.
Pianist Don Pullen.
So I would have to wait until he finished before I could get there and warm up. Then it would be just a few minutes left, you know.
You're listening to a tribute to Charles Mingus on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. Pressure. Mingus combined the toxin of high expectations with a need to mold time. In his pieces and in his life, an explosive combination. Mingus turned a 1962 opportunity to perform at Manhattan's Midtown upscale town hall inside out.
He blew the concert.
Buddy Collette and Britt Woodman were there, always there for their childhood friend. When Buddy flew into New York from Los Angeles just a few days before the concert, the music wasn't ready yet. Some claim the producer moved up the date of the concert by a chunk of weeks. Mingus's ambitions for the event, he hoped to debut a major extended composition, and the fixed curtain just ahead collided. He decided to fix the concert's producer and outfoxed himself.
And he said, I got this 35-piece band, it's a concert. I want it to be a open recording session. He had this idea again. He always had ideas. I want to be able to stop in the middle of the concert and say, well, what do you think?
With all that tuxedos. Charles comes in with some jeans and tennis shoes. Now, the idea of this concert was we're supposed to play as if we were in the studio recording.
And he walked to the mic and said, hello. And he said, well, this isn't going to be a concert, and we're going to stop and start. And if you all don't like it, you can get your money and get out. So he went into the first number, and he had his bass out. They had George DeVivier, Milt Hinton, just name all the line, four or five top basses, Joe Benjamin, whatever. One of the first tunes, very exciting. And right in the middle, when it just began to take off, he did something like that and cut the band off. And he walked to the mic and he says, I wouldn't buy that, would you? And he kind of chuckled, you know, but it's in the air now. Now, I don't know if the guys were aware. I know this is going to be the pattern, because now he's got it going his way at any cost.
Another great idea.
And it wasn't going well, and he wasn't doing well.
Mingus's therapist, Dr. Edmund Pollock.
At one point, he stopped and asked if his analyst was there, which is crazy. So I was. At intermission, I tried to talk to him. I settled him down. Talks at length with him. And this is a crowded town hall that came to see him. And I emphasized that they were coming to see him. And he did settle down.
So right near the, you know, 11 o'clock time, 5 to 11, the stagehands begin to pull the curtain slowly, you know. Clark Terry, I'll never forget him because he was a beauty. He just picked up his horn then, and because Mingus was either talking or spacing around, he didn't know where he was. And Clark Terry said, dee-ba-da, in a mellow tone, he started the trumpet. The band was so starved, you know, and frustrated for not playing. They all start setting riffs, and then the audience came out, and they got up from their seats and went and grabbed the curtains and pulled them back, and we blew at each other for a while.
Sue Mingus, Mingus's widow, refers to the town hall concert as
the central tragedy of Charles's life. If he had been able to show the world who he was musically, in 1962, his life would have been very different.
Still, the next week, Mingus went on to a successful date at Birdland. And the following year, The Black Saint and The Sinner Lady was released. The music, Mingus said, got him out of a mental institution.
Thank you.
At one of the low periods in his life, Mingus worked to get into an institution most preferred to stay out of. Bellevue Hospital, a mental institution, the Loony Bin. He described the event in his inventive interpretive memoir, Beneath the Underground, here read by Kermit Frazier.
There was a guy in a sort of booth or sentry box, and I went to him and asked him how to get in. He wouldn't open the gates. We talked through the bars. I said, look, man, I said, I am mentally disturbed. I'm a musician. I need help. And I once saw a film that said, if you need help, the first and most difficult task is having the guts to ask for it. So help me, man. The gatekeeper said, I done told you this is not where you want to go if you just sleepy. I can see from here you look a little tired, so go home, man, and go to bed. Ain't crazy or nothing, are you? I said, maybe I am, maybe I'm not. And he said, well, take my word for it, you don't want to come in here. If I was to let you in, first thing you'd say when I close that door behind you is, let me out, I ain't crazy.
He thought it was very dramatic, I think, is my feeling, that he'd go up and knock on the door and say, I need some help.
Celia Mingus Sands, wife number two.
And then he got in there, and then he couldn't get out.
At least he had good company. Chess champion Bobby Fischer was in then, too. They shared a few games. And as always, Mingus was composing music, using the mind that the Bellevue doctors wanted to operate on. A lobotomy, they claimed, would cure what they diagnosed as his paranoia. Luckily, the composer got out, brain intact, and still with the music that led to his album-length composition, Black Saint and the Sinner Lady, an album Mingus thought was one of his best. Mingus asked the man who'd sprung him from Bellevue, his therapist, Dr. Edmund Pollock, to write the psyche examining liner notes.
In a way, I connected him with some kind of Black Saint because through his music, he was always playing his theme. His theme of being alone, his theme of being hurt. And unfortunately, he acted it out.
From liner notes written by the Black Saint himself.
This music is only one little wave of styles and waves of little ideas my mind has encompassed through living in a society that calls itself sane. As long as you're not behind iron bars, where there at least one can't be half as crazy as in most of the ventures our leaders take upon themselves to do and think for us, even to the day we should be blown up to preserve their idea of how life should be. Crazy? They'd never get out of the observation ward at Bellevue. I did. So listen how. Play this record. We'll be right back. At this point, I'd like to pause for station identification. Station soul and love.
I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR's Jazz Profiles, with a tribute to Charles Mingus. From the mid-60s through the early 70s, Mingus made trips to Europe and Scandinavia, attracting large audiences for his music and for his anticipated antics as well. He obliged on both counts. On his first tour in April 1964, Mingus brought what many considered to be one of his best bands.
Thank you, kindly. Now we bring to the bandstand Eric Dolphy, bass clarinet, and alto saxophone, and flute. Danny Richmond, drums, and Jackie's over there, Byard, Jackie Byard, piano. Clifford Jordan, a borrow from Max Roach on tenor saxophone. Meditation. Thank you.
thousands of people on metal folding chairs, on wooden bleachers, on the sparse grass outside the chain-link fence. Blue sky, fine clouds, except for the rows in front, near the stage. The big crowd scarcely quiets for the musicians. Even Thelonious Monk barely stifles the audience at the Monterey Jazz Festival this summer of 1964 until Charles Mingus comes out. Standing stage right, leading a 12-piece big band, the crowd becomes silent. Even beer doesn't dare slosh. John Handy and Red Callender, Mingus's first bass teacher, witnessed.
That was such monumental music. Charles was elated, and I was inside, honestly, totally happy for him. I was really, you know, for him, because we all worked our butts off to make that happen. I'm very proud to have been part of that.
I played tuba on that one. He had a big band, and he'd go around and say, hey, you know, it's called a sotto voce, do this, do this, do this. And it, somehow we made some magic on that program. At least I felt it was magic.
I say, let my children have music. For God's sake, rid this society of some of the noise so that those who have ears will be able to use them someplace listening to good music.
Despite his many successes, Mingus felt underappreciated, underrecognized, the underdog. For years at a time, he went into relative seclusion, sometimes composing, never recording. After one extensive layover in the early 70s, he resumed performing and released Let My Children Hear Music. Dozens of albums and nearly three decades after Charles Mingus entered the music business, after music entered him, he got a Grammy nomination for liner notes. It wasn't until 1997 that Mingus received a Grammy for his music, the Lifetime Achievement Award. But by then, the life had long gone out of the man.
Let my children have music. Let them hear live music, not noise. My children, you do what you want with your own.
It's possible for a man who ate four steaks at a sitting, everybody's salad, God knows what else, plus a couple of bottles of wine, good wine, mind you, and finish that off with a party's worth of ice cream. It's possible for a man of Mingus's many appetites. It's possible nothing no amount of public acclaim, attention, or mention would have been enough. Pianist Jackie Byard.
Why didn't it come to me when I was 21 years old? I was playing my ass off. You know, wait all this time and shit. I was flaming. I was a flame back when I was 20 and 21.
Lincoln Center, February 4th, 1972. Nearly a decade since Mingus's town hall debacle in New York City. Among the offerings, Little Royal Suite, tough music, long music. At rehearsals, the musicians saw a change in the formerly fearsome bandleader. Everyone saw it. Medicated, tired, sick. An overwhelming heaviness of being. Still, that night, and over the next couple of years, Mingus put out more extraordinary music, perverting chords, tweaking expectations. The mind was turning, even if the body was weak. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR's Jazz Profiles, with a tribute to Charles Mingus. After consulting healers, curers, would-be diagnosers, after prayers and exhortations, after exhaustion, after hope, MDs have the answer. Delivered on the day before Thanksgiving, 1977. Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease. Doctors say he has 3 to 6 months to live.
Over time, I could see Lou Gehrig's disease take more and more irreversible hold until the last time I saw him there, he could not speak really, but he was composing music by humming or whistling, or humming, I guess it was.
Charles Mingus's longtime friend, writer Nat Hentoff.
The very last time I saw him, was at that remarkable White House Jazz Festival on the South Lawn. Mingus was sitting in a wheelchair in the front row. He was quite moved by whatever it was that Carter said to him. And then I went over and we sort of embraced. I don't think I'll ever forget that scene.
June 18th, 1978. President Jimmy Carter did what no president had done before him. A jazz festival at the White House. Ironically, the man who emceed, Mingus despised. Jazz producer, George Wein.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask you now to acknowledge a man in the audience. He's one of the greatest musicians of our generation. He's a man whose courage and strength is only exceeded by his talent and creativity. He's sitting over here, ladies and gentlemen. I want you to stand up for this one, because I want you to give as great a round of applause as he ever had in his life for Charlie Mingus. Come on, Mingus, stand up, will you?
But standing wasn't possible. By then, wheelchair-bound, Mingus, Charles Mingus, as he insisted on being called, could not.
We were on a plane 3 days later. We had nothing to lose. We went down and stayed with the witches and the healers for 6 months until he died.
Sue Mingus took her husband to Mexico, to Cuernavaca.
Mm-hmm.
Just weeks before the end, Buddy Collette, who'd known Mingus longer, better, and truer than probably anybody, paid a visit.
He couldn't even talk to me. He made me get a word out. Chaos that was going on there, the snails all over the wall, because they were into some treatment from this doctor, not a doctor, but, you know, a healer or whatever. Well, eat 24 snails a day. She'd cut him on the back, and there was no scar there. Get the cow dung, they'd chase the cows down and put that on the back, pack it with something. I looked in the bathroom with the snails. They brought maybe a couple of dozen, and they multiplied to the point that I was scary. I said, don't go in that bathroom because that's where the snails are. He's in this wheelchair looking like Ironside or something and couldn't move. You know, just the eyes were talking and saying it. I stayed there for about 3 or 4 days. That was plenty long enough. I said, this is chaos. You know, he food fanging out of his mouth, and he kept doing his fingers to me. The eye said, I will play. I could read his eyes, and because I knew him, you know. So he needed to come back. They took me to the airport. We had to go, like, to Mexico City or whatever. We had to go up there. And she said, Charles, do you want to go? And I said, we're going to bring you home. His eyes were just saying, thank you. Get to the airport, and it was almost like I watched him. He just couldn't take his eyes off when I flew away. What a feel. I could never tell you what that felt like.
The chill of death as she clutched my hand. I knew she was coming, so I stood like a man. She drew up closer, close enough for me to look into her face, and then began to wonder, hadn't I seen her some other place? She beckoned for me to come closer, as if to pay an old debt. I knew what she wanted. It wasn't quite time yet. She threw her arms about me, as many women had done before. I heard her whisper, you'll never cheat me. Never anymore.
Charles Mingus passed, not away, but on January 4th, 1979.
India. I'm going to be buried in India. I got it all planned.
Sue took his ashes to India, scattering them on the sacred Mother Holy River, the Ganges. Mingus believed in many religions, in the truth of the spirit, under whatever name. He believed in reincarnation, where, as the saying goes, bird lives. Mingus is.
Oh, he's reincarnated every time we hear his music. There's no doubt about that. I asked him at one point whether he was going to come back afterwards. I figured if anyone would find his way back, and he said, I'm never going to leave. And he has not. He is around here in his music.
In a sense, musically, Mingus was reincarnated in his symphonic 2+ hours long work, Epitaph, performed 10 years after his death. All 4,000 measures of it, as reconstructed by several, arranged and copied by many, and conducted by Gunther Schuller. The New York Times said that the concert ranked among the most memorable jazz events of the decade. Others said that it was more Schuller than Mingus, that the music lacked spirit without the life force that created it up there, up here, on the bandstand. Mingus lives on, too, in the many tribute albums. Singer Joni Mitchell, bassist Tom Hubbard, and producer Hal Wilner all released them. But it's especially in the Mingus Big Band that the music continues. At first, the 14-piece band was fronted and populated by Mingus veterans and called the Mingus Dynasty.
I can remember the first week that I was asked to play with the Dynasty was at the Village Vanguard.
Bassist Ray Drummond.
I can remember the first 2 or 3 nights, you know, it's kind of like playing things, the hearing things coming out of my bass, and I'm standing back and sitting in the audience myself listening and saying, where did that come from? You know, I've never practiced anything like that. You know, things just coming out of the bass that I said, I don't have anything to do with this. And, you know, it felt as if, you know, Mingus was they're saying, okay, now look, kid, this is how you're supposed to do it. This is how it goes. You know, you'll have it in a minute, but let me just give you, you know, a couple of pointers about this. So it was really quite a sort of an out-of-body experience.
Where, in life, Charles Mingus could be fearsome, his musical legacy is awesome. Nat Hentoff.
You can't listen in terms of, oh, yeah, that's great bop, or that's great swing, or that's great whatever. It simply transcends all that stuff, and it moves beyond any kind of categories. And that's what makes it, I think, not perishable. It lasts because of that.
Charles Mingus played and made music that moves us, thrills us, shapes us, chills us. In whatever form, Mingus is still among us. Our tribute to Charles Mingus was written and produced by Karen Michelle. David Gorin mixed the program at the Stephen Erickson Studio. Special thanks to Pacifica Radio, Phil Elwood, the Library of Congress, Patricia Willard, the Smithsonian Institution, Sue Mingus, John DiLiberto, the New York and Los Angeles NPR bureaus, David Dorn of Rhino Records, and Karen's dog, Mingus. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. Assistant producer, Madeline Smith. Executive producers, Mary Beth Kirshner and Murray Horwitz. To email us and for more information about this and other Jazz Profiles programs, check out NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web. Our address is npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.